For another take on the clinical implications of new research data sets in lung cancer, at ASCO, I met with Dr. Heather Wakely, principal investigator of the recently launched ECOG 5505 adjuvant trial. Dr. Wakely began our conversation by commenting on what she sees as the most important lung cancer research reports at the ASCO meeting.
I think the biggest impact on practice is going to be what we do with the stage 3 patients. The trial presented by Nasser Hanna on the Hoosier Oncology Group protocol that looked at chemotherapy with cisplatin and etoposide with concurrent radiation for unresectable stage 3A and 3B disease was the most practice-changing. And what they were looking at, the question was all patients got the chemotherapy radiation, and then they were randomized to either receive consolidation docetaxel using the standard Southwest Oncology Group 9504 protocol, or nothing, just the two cycles of cisplatin etoposide with radiation. And what they showed was absolutely no difference in survival between the two arms, with pretty strikingly overlapped survival curves. Criticisms are that it was a relatively small study. It was stopped early because of an interim analysis showing that there was no way statistically to get a separation of the curves. But it really does bring up this question of what is consolidation chemotherapy doing in that situation. There were also a couple of studies in the poster discussion session which looked at more of an induction chemotherapy with then additional chemo radiation in a similar patient population, which also didn't show any benefit with the chemotherapy. And so it's really, again, bringing into the forefront this question of what do we do with stage 3? I think for several years, everyone's been comfortable with the 9504 regimen, even though it was a unvalidated phase 2 results. And now we have to really question that. I don't know that I have yet bought into the idea that it's completely dead, that we shouldn't be looking at induction anymore or we shouldn't be looking at consolidation anymore. I have a hard time believing that two cycles of a platinum doublet with radiation is really enough to cure stage 3 when we know we need more than that to help improve survival for earlier stages. So I don't think the question's dead, but I think we need to move away from just doing 9504 and building on that. So I think that's, again, the biggest practice-changing impact. The thing that isn't being talked about at all, though, is I think many, many people are still using a weekly carbo-based regimen with a taxane with the radiation. And to say that we shouldn't give any more chemo after that is far more frightening proposition, given that they're not getting very much chemotherapy at all during the radiation. And if you look at the median survival times from those phase 2 trials, excluding the CLGB study, but looking at some of the phase 2 and even some of the data that was presented earlier yesterday, they're right in keeping with what we're seeing with these cisetoposide radiation regimens with or without the docetaxel. So I think we still have a lot of questions in stage 3, but I think that as a general practice in consolidation, docetaxel cannot really be considered a standard anymore.
What about the issue of using biologics, and particularly biologics during the chemo radiation therapy?
Needs to be looked at carefully. I think we have a lot of concerns about the epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitors, and that was another one of the big abstracts that came out yesterday with, well, not new, but sort of confirmatory data from Karen Kelly's earlier presentation of the SWOG 023 study, which added maintenance gefitinib, and it was a randomized question, after the cisetoposide radiation docetaxel regimen. And we had seen the initial results 2 years ago showing that, if anything, the gefitinib was increasing toxicity, and she pretty much showed, not necessarily increasing toxicity, but not improving survival. And we saw that again, where there was a definite detriment in overall survival for those who got the gefitinib. Primarily, it seemed like due to increased secondary cancers, which is hard to explain, not so much the toxicity issue. They weren't looking at giving the drug with concurrent chemotherapy radiation. That has been done in some smaller trials without a lot of increased toxicity, but there's no hint that it's really helping in survival. We don't have any big trials yet or even published results with adding in the angiogenesis inhibitors, but certainly toxicity concerns have been raised, and legitimately so, causing some of the trials to be stopped, at least temporarily. So I think we do want to be looking at adding the targeted agents, but I don't know which ones to go after.
What about cetuximab?
The initial data from that looks intriguing. Again, it's too early to really say anything, and that certainly hasn't been highlighted too much yet. There were some posters.
Getting back to that 0023 study, mm-hmm. looking at gefitinib, I was always trying to figure out sort of from the sidelines whether or not, you know, when you think about, was this really a detrimental effect of the gefitinib or could it have been numbers? I mean, there wasn't an enriched population that they were looking at.
Right.
Any more information about whether or not this could have just been statistical play as opposed to some kind of actual counterproductive effect?
Be very hard to be statistical play with that big of a difference.
What are some of the speculations as to what's going on?
Well, there's a concern that perhaps there's some change that happens with the radiation and the chemotherapy beforehand that is somehow making cells more sensitive, normal cells more sensitive to the EGFR inhibition that might be somehow leading to neoplastic changes. I mean, it's all hand-waving at this point, but that is certainly one of the possibilities.
Another presentation I was curious about mm-hmm. your thoughts about was the AVAIL study.
Right.
Can you kind of go through sort of what that looked at and what they presented here?
Sure. So that was a European study of gemcitabine and cisplatinum with or without bevacizumab. And they actually looked at two doses of bevacizumab, 7.5 milligrams per kilogram or 15 milligram per kilogram dose. But again, the 15 was the dose used in the ECOG 4599 carboplatin study from the U.S., their study was initially an overall survival study, but they changed it to be a progression-free survival endpoint. And the data presented yesterday was just the progression-free survival results. Overall survival wasn't mature yet. And what they showed was a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival. Not a big difference, but a real difference, statistically so, with both the 7.5 and the 15. They weren't powered to compare 15 to 7.5, just both of those doses to the placebo.
I mean, kind of looking at it, though, which maybe we shouldn't do because that wasn't the intent, I think a lot of people might come away mm-hmm. with the question, can you get away with 7.5 practically?
Right, and that is a big question. And the discussant, Tom Lynch, yesterday certainly made the point that maybe we should be thinking of 7.5 as the dose to use. I'm a little cautious still because what we have is response data showing that either dose improves response. We have progression-free survival data showing that, yes, you improve things, but it was less than a month improvement for both of them. We don't have the survival data yet, but there was really no way of looking at any difference numerically, at least between the 15 and the 7.5, even if you couldn't do it statistically. So I don't think it's necessarily wrong to think about using 7.5, but I'm not ready to make the change in my practice, and certainly we won't be making a change in the adjuvant trial where we're still using the 15 every 3 weeks.
Any theoretical way to sort this thing out in terms of, you know, sort of the lower limit that you would need in order to saturate, I guess, you know, whatever, the VEGF receptors?
There could be, but we haven't figured out how to do it yet. We found a lot of prognostic markers, but we haven't really found anything that helps us predict who's going to respond and who isn't. I think if we could do that, if we knew which target we were really going after, other than VEGF in general, that would be helpful. But as you know, VEGF levels correlate with survival. They don't correlate with response to the drugs. And we just heard the mesothelioma presentation of adding bevacizumab in that situation with gemcitabine cisplatin, which didn't show a survival advantage. But also the VEGF levels, if anything, were the opposite of what you would have expected, where having a lower VEGF level predicted for better response to the bevacizumab. So I think we are very far away from understanding how to predict who's going to benefit from the drug. And I think we need to do that before we're able to predict, can we get away really with the lower dose?
Right now, what are you consider sort of reasonable non-protocol options in terms of chemotherapy regimens to combine with Bev for metastatic disease?
Well, I think that we can, obviously in the United States, carboplatin paclitaxel with bevacizumab is what's approved. I think given the AVAIL data and the very interesting and promising toxicity data, I mean, it was less toxic than what we saw with the carboplatin, that gem-cis would certainly be a reasonable thing to go to now. We're doing an ongoing trial with carboplatin and gemcitabine. I wouldn't say that regimen's quite ready for prime time yet until we get the toxicity data, given the increased thrombocytopenia and neutropenia with that regimen anyway, and the potential with adding the bevacizumab for making that worse. It is one of the options in an ongoing trial, and I think in the trial setting it's reasonable, but I'm not sure it's ready to go to. I think that substituting docetaxel for paclitaxel is very reasonable. We don't have any toxicity differences there particularly that would be a big concern, so.
How do you yourself go about making the decision in your own practice off the protocol?
Well, if I'm treating someone off protocol, I'm using carboplatin paclitaxel, but I'm obviously funneling most of my patients to my trial with carboplatin gemcitabine.
You mentioned the toxicity that was seen in the AVAIL trial. Can you go through that a little bit more?
The bleeding risk was lower than expected. They really didn't see any significant CNS hemorrhages, which had been something that had been raised, obviously, with the carbotaxol. And one thing that came out also was that about 9% of patients on the trial were actually on therapeutic anticoagulation. There was an exclusion criteria for people going on, but once they were on, ended up needing it, they were able to stay on, and there was no increased bleeding for that group either.
Any sort of theoretical reason? I mean, we're starting out with a pretty small number. It's an indirect comparison between two trials, but any reason to think why you might see less hemoptysis or bleeding?
Well, they had slightly different inclusion and exclusion criteria. One other thing that came out was their bleeding was not higher for the central tumors. You know, the numbers for both studies were not that high, and it was reassuring to see that they were no higher for this. I don't think that from a theoretical concept of the two drugs, I mean, we didn't see a lot more thrombocytopenia, which would obviously be the concern with the gemcitabine. I think it was just reassuring more than anything.
Anything new in terms of the theoretical mechanism of why you see the bleeding? There were attempts to try to dissect that out, particularly at the last ASCO meeting. Anything new in that regard?
No, I mean, we still know that there's definite correlation between patients that have a cavitary response in their tumor and bleeding. That's the only thing I've seen that's really been in any way validated. And even there, it's small numbers, so it's not truly validated.
What's happening in terms of your trial, the adjuvant study, the 1505 study, the ECOG?
So it just activated 2 days ago, actually.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
That was quick enough, huh?
It's open. We'll just focus on that. So we are, I think, more comfortable than ever with our choice of regimens. Cisplatin gemcitabine is one of the regimens, and now we have large trial validating the safety profile there. We're also still including cisplatin vinorelbine and cisplatin docetaxel with a little bit of extrapolation on safety there. But I think with the proven safety now with cisgem, we're comfortable with that. At this point, we're still sticking with the 15 milligram per kilogram dosing, given that that's where we have known proven survival benefit.
What about stage and 1B specifically?
So at this point, we are limiting the 1Bs just to those whose tumors are 4 centimeters or greater. A lot of discussion went into that. We know from subset analyses of the larger adjuvant trials that the 1B patients don't seem to benefit overall. We know from the 1B CLGB trial that the trial was overall statistically negative. But in those tumors that were 4 centimeters or greater, patients with those tumors, they did have a survival benefit. So that's where we came up with the 4 centimeter cut point. And that's what we're moving forward with.
And what are the other eligibility criteria?
At this point, we're not limiting to any histology. We're also not limiting it to patients who are off of anticoagulation, so we're able to include that given that they won't have any large tumor, and based on the safety data that's come out from the colorectal patients and now the hints of it that have come out of the AVAIL study. Patients who've had any sort of stroke or transient ischemic attack are excluded. Patients who've had any other sort of arterial thrombotic events, such as myocardial, within 6 months are also excluded.
What exactly is the regimen? How long is the Bev continued?
The investigator with the patient must choose a chemotherapy regimen up front. The cisplatin backbone is 75 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks for 4 cycles on all of them. The vinorelbine is 30 milligrams per meter squared days 1 and 8. The docetaxel is 75 on day 1 only. And the gemcitabine is 1,200 milligrams per meter squared, days 1 and 8. The bevacizumab, as I mentioned, is the 15 milligram per kilogram dosing every 3 weeks, starting with the first cycle of chemotherapy and then continuing for 1 year.
When you sort of look across other tumor types and see the safety data that's evolving of bevacizumab, of course, there are trials in colon and breast also. What are some of the data sets that have come out in the last year in terms of safety that have implications for adjuvant therapy that you all considered in this?
Well, obviously, the nasal septal perforation is a minor issue, but something that came out. The reversible posterior leukoencephalopathy certainly gave us pause, but since it's reversible and identifiable, less of a concern. The concern of CNS events was a big issue. But there's some reassurance given the AVAIL trial. There's also a poster today showing that the risk for hemorrhagic events in the brain, even with patients with brain metastases, is not that high in lung cancer patients. And so that was a little bit reassuring, though not directly related to this study. The long-term use of the drug is something we don't know much about. And clearly, as an anti-angiogenic drug, there's a risk for increasing myocardial infarctions, increasing risk of stroke. the AVAIL data is reassuring in that they weren't seeing it, but again, these are patients with metastatic disease who don't have a long life expectancy. In the adjuvant setting, we're going to have patients, though they're only exposed to the agent for a year, are then going to be hopefully living for a number of years thereafter. And that is something we're going to have to watch for, and we won't know until the study's probably already finished accruing. And that is a concern, but again, given the extreme lethality of the disease when it recurs, I think that we're still going to, if the drug ends up showing the survival benefit, we are hoping it will, I think that that will offset any potential deficit to survival related to cardiac mortality. So,
what were some of the discussions that went on in determining that you're going to take the Bev out to a year?
Our first initial thought was perhaps to go to 2 years because that's the highest risk of relapse with this disease. But obviously there was a lot of pushback on that given, first of all, the cost of the drug and the safety concerns of long-term angiogenesis. And so we came up with the compromise basically of the year.
How do you think people are going to respond, or how are they responding to the idea of the trial, and what are you projecting in terms of accrual? We know, I think I sent you some patterns of care data where we polled oncologists, and clearly, and no big surprise, the most common regimen that's used right now is carboplatin. Mm-hmm. How do you think people are going to respond to the study?
Well, obviously, when people come to talk to me about it, I hear a lot of enthusiastic response to the idea of the study. I think that as we move forward in lung cancer, we want to try to cure more people. And while we've got a long way to go in metastatic disease, we are slowly making some steps in curing more people with early stage disease. And given that bevacizumab is still the only agent that's shown a real survival advantage when added to chemotherapy in the metastatic disease, and given the promising sort of preclinical work that hints that it's going to be even potentially more effective when you've got microscopic disease, there's a lot of enthusiasm that this is the way to go in adjuvant. I think people are wary of considering doing that off of a study, and so I think that's going to help accrual to the trial. The carboplatin issue, that might cause some people to pause. But in stage 3, people don't have much of a problem using cisplatin. Cisplatin and etoposide is what the majority of people are using in stage 3, where we thought that we had this definite data that was the way to go. And so I think that in the adjuvant setting, even though all the trials have been with cisplatin, we don't have any carboplatin trial other than the one that was negative. I think that if physicians feel like their only way of giving bevacizumab is with cisplatin, I don't think it's going to be as big of an accrual problem. I might be proven wrong. That might just be my hopefulness leading to that interpretation, but I don't see it being a major problem.
It would be cool, too, if I guess the NSABP has the trial that's, I think, as far as I know, is going to be the first one to report in the adjuvant setting with colon.
Right.
Who knows when that's going to be, but if that comes out positive, I'm sure the enthusiasm for lung and breast is going to increase exponentially.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think people actually are excited about the adjuvant Bev trials sort of indirectly because of the Herceptin studies, just the hope that targeted therapy is going to have a big impact in the adjuvant setting. Right now, what do we know about the actual fraction of patients who present potentially with stage disease that could go in the study? What fraction overall of lung cancer do you think fits into that?
It's going to be a high percentage of the patients in that stage. Our eligibility criteria are pretty open. One of the things I forgot to mention earlier, there's a pretty big window. It's 6 to 12 weeks postoperatively that patients can be randomized, so we tried to be a little bit more inclusive there. They can have had a number of different surgeries that we do mandate some degree of mediastinal lymph node, at least sampling, to make sure that we really know the stage as people go into things.
What fraction of patients overall right now today are presenting with or getting surgery, basically, that theoretically would fit into this study?
It's still probably only 30-40% of all lung cancer patients present in that stage.
Anything else that's come out here at ASCO you might want to comment on?
I just came from the second oral session. And there was a lot of talk there about neoadjuvant therapies.
Right.
The LU22 trial was presented, as well as an update on the SWOG 9900 trial. The LU22 study showed absolutely no difference in the patients who received the neoadjuvant chemotherapy versus those who did not.
Can you go through the design of that study?
Sure. It was a study done in the UK giving 3 cycles of cisplatin-based neoadjuvant chemotherapy versus none. And they randomized somewhere in the 500s of patients. And overall, like I said, there was no survival benefit. but they also showed no significant toxicity issues per se. They were able to get about 75% of the chemotherapy in. And the spin on it, even though the trial was negative, was that if you put this in with all of the other neoadjuvant trials that have been presented, it adds a large number of patients and still ends up with the hazard ratio in the 0.8 range. 0.81, I think, was what they had come up with. So they sort of spun it as a, even though the trial was negative, it really doesn't change our overall feelings about neoadjuvant, that it might be as positive as adjuvant. And the 9900 presentation by Kathy Pisters, which was using carbotaxol, they actually, again, were statistically not positive, though numerically it did show a survival benefit.
I guess one of the things about that is, you know, could you get more chemotherapy in if you use it prior to surgery? What do we know about that?
So if you look at the adjuvant trials, the amount of chemotherapy that was given was in the 60 to 70% range for most of those trials. And the data that Kathy Pisters just presented for the 9900 was a little bit higher than that, but the LU22 was right at 75.
I want to ask you about the issue of non-smokers who get lung cancer, and you published a great paper recently on that, and you published a bunch of things on that. Can you kind of provide an update of what we know about that?
Well, at this point, what we know is that in the United States, the percentage of people who develop lung cancer who've never smoked, it's about 20% of the women, about 8 or 9% of the men. In Asia, the numbers are even more striking, where there's a much, much higher percentage of women who get lung cancer are never smokers. We know that from Japan. We know that from China and Korea. We don't know why. I mean, there's certainly a lot of theories about secondhand smoke. There's a lot of data about cooking oil, in particular in Asia.
Cooking oil?
Yeah, cooking oil. Women being exposed to toxic fumes in unventilated situations, high heat cooking oil. There's been some data there. There's some looking at viruses, papillomavirus in particular. A lot of sort of hand waving and, you know, maybe this is it, maybe this is that, where we don't know. We know that people who've never smoked are more likely to harbor EGFR mutations and be more sensitive to those drugs. We know that they tend to live longer than people who've developed cancer from smoking overall, regardless of therapy. So those are some of the things that we do know. We don't know necessarily what therapies to use differently. We know from the BR21 trial with erlotinib that the never smokers were more likely to benefit from the erlotinib, but we don't know that we should be giving that necessarily earlier, just that they're going to do better with it.
What about the trials right now that are looking at erlotinib in these enriched populations, either non-smokers, I guess oligosmokers, or mutation? Where are we with that? And do you think that the 0023 data in any way might impact those trials?
So most of those trials are still in metastatic disease. I don't think the 0023 is going to have a big impact there because that was more of a maintenance.
I was thinking more of the adjuvant study.
Yeah. There are ongoing adjuvant trials with the drugs, too, focusing on an enriched patient population. So again, moving away from the 0023 unenriched population. They're not really looking at the never smoker question directly, other than that those are patients potentially more likely to either harbor mutations or have overexpression of EGFR. As far as looking at the enriched patient population studies, there was an oral presentation yesterday by Alicia Sequest where they had taken patients who had documented mutations in the EGFR and gave them upfront erlotinib and had a response rate in the, I think, 50-plus percent range, which was quite good. It was a small study, only about 30 patients, so it's hard to draw any significant conclusions from that other than with enrichment they were able to get a high response rate. We know that in trials from Asia, particularly trials of never smokers from Asia and, you know, predominantly women, that the response rates first line with gefitinib or erlotinib are quite high. They can be in the 60s percent ranges, even higher in some of those.
Anything new that's developed over the last year in terms of the mechanisms of why you see more responses in these patients?
I think a lot of it has to do with the mutations and knowing that those are the patients more likely to harbor the mutation, particularly the deletion 19 mutations, the ones that really confer a very high rate of response.
Anything new in terms of why the mutation is associated? I mean, in the beginning, we heard this thing about somehow the way the TKI fits in there. Is anything more definitive that's come out?
Not that I've seen clearly. We know that patients who develop cancers in that situation, their tumors are really driven by the mutation, that they're sort of the oncogene-dependent tumors. And that's why when we're able to block that oncogene, they can really do quite well for a period of time. There's a lot that has come out on why those patients eventually fail the suppression, the T790M mutation. Again, that was something that people have been talking about a lot this year and have shown pretty clearly that you've got patients who, with the deletion 19, they get the T790, they lose their response to the EGFR inhibition. And so that story is pretty interesting, as well as a little bit of work with MET kind of in that story as well, and then ideas of how to potentially overcome the resistance then.
Anything that's come out at this meeting that relates to the issue of choice of therapy, metastatic disease, any new agents, new trials that you think are worth talking about?
I think we're still left with a platinum doublet, potentially even a non-platinum doublet. There were some trials yesterday that talked about carboplatin and pemetrexed as another platinum doublet. Sure, it's reasonable. It's maybe less toxic than some of the options, but it's no better. And you then are losing, you know, an agent that's commonly used second line. Is that good, bad? I think it's just a matter of ordering of things, and I don't think it's a huge step forward. It's certainly a nice another option.
In your patients mm-hmm. in a non-protocol setting who are not eligible or you don't want to give them bevacizumab, mm-hmm. what you're usually using first line?
I tend to use a lot of carboplatin and gemcitabine. I'll use carboplatin paclitaxel. It's sort of between those two when we talk about toxicity differences, scheduling differences as we're going through with each patient. Occasionally, I'll use cisplatin, a backbone as well, if the patient wants to be very, very aggressive.
How about second line?
Second line, I use a lot of pemetrexed up front, except in patients who I think are more likely to be an EGFR responder. So the never smokers in particular, Asian, I have a lot of Asian patients in my practice. But we'll always talk about the differences between the two and picking. And someone who's had a great chemotherapy response, I'll go with chemotherapy drug second, you know, after discussion with them about their erlotinib.
What about using erlotinib first line in an enriched patient?
I don't do that. I haven't been convinced that that's the right way to go because those patients tend to do better with chemotherapy as well. And unless someone has a performance status reason or some other concern where I don't think they're going to tolerate the chemotherapy, I like to talk to my patients about that we're treating this as sort of a long haul maintenance. We want to keep your disease under control for as long as we can. We don't want to necessarily use the erlotinib first. If we can get a good response with chemotherapy that can buy you 8 months there, then we can come in with your erlotinib next, buy you a year there maybe. Then we can go to whatever's next on trial or coming back to other single agent chemotherapy drugs. So that's how I do it. I know it's different than how some other people are practicing. Where in the enriched population, they do consider giving the EGFR inhibitors first line. Patients don't work with those forever. You know, they only last a year, sometimes a little longer, sometimes a little bit less. And there is some concern that perhaps you lose some of your chemotherapy response if you've given the EGFR inhibitor up front again. Is there definite data there? No. But there are some hints that patients who have a truly EGFR-driven tumor, by the time they lose their response to the EGFR inhibitor because of additional mutations, those tumors are then a little bit more aggressive and a little bit harder to control even with the chemo. It's theoretical, but that's sort of the way I'm interpreting it right now.
Anything new that's come out recently in terms of the rash and particularly management of the rash?
I think there's not any clear consensus at this time. And again, at least for me, I'm not dosing to rash. I'm not considering that patients have to have a rash in order to have response. I've had a number of them who haven't had any significant rash who have had definite benefit from the drug. But again, there are folks on the other side of that argument as well. I think it's just a matter of balancing good skin care, antibiotics when necessary to get it under control.
Any new agents that may be coming into a clinical setting in the near future that you're excited about?
There were some reports of activity with some of the other multiple targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors, particularly some of the VEGF receptor targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors. There are a lot of them kind of out there, and I think there'll be more that we're hearing about in the next couple years. So I don't know that I could name one or two in particular. Vendetinib has clearly been making some inroads with some of their combination studies as well. Axitinib got some presentation information yesterday from Dr. Schiller, showed some response. Then there are others. So I'm watching those closely. I think that we're a little ways away still, but it's very promising to have so many exciting new drugs coming out.